it's very validating to hear you say these things, and based on just your just watching videos of her, and you know, my first impression of Soltram was very underwhelming. I even read her book Feeding Your Demons, and I was I've always been very literary, and at the time I was also rather accomplished academically, and I was very unimpressed by just the writing style of Feeding Your Demons. I was like, this book reads like it was written by someone very unintelligent. And I remember even telling my father that, because he was very educated, and him sort of trying to explain to me, like, well, it's a self-help book. It doesn't have to be well written. And I was like, okay, sure. Let me reframe my orientation here. But it is really vile that she's... she uses religion to aggrandize herself, and you know, the way that she is able to receive the experience that makes her feel aggrandizement is the destruction of others. The only way she can feel good about herself is by always hitting someone else over the head and making sure that they feel smaller than she does. I would say, so the breaking point was, I'm going to try to be as concise about this as possible. In my first 6 months at Tara Mandala, like I said, I was hazed. I was essentially iced out by the entire community for speaking too casually to Lama Soltram in my first week. And all of these people who were my friends and family completely stopped speaking to me for about a 6 month period. And I didn't know why, and no one would train me in my job. And there was this kind of terrible setup where Lama Soltram's other assistant, Anna, was supposed to train me, but she resented me for a number of things. Mostly she didn't like that I got a nicer cabin than she did when she started. And she was pretty furious about that. So she decided just not to do it and didn't tell anyone. And so watched me just stumble constantly. And then I was reprimanded constantly for not doing my job correctly, but no one would tell me how to do it. When I would ask how to do it, I would be screamed at and told, you should know how to do this. Why do you ask so many questions? Figure something out for yourself. Then I try to figure something out for myself, and I'd be screamed at, you're so arrogant. Why do you think you know everything? So I was in this impossible situation where all I could do was fail. And Lama Soltram wouldn't talk to me, even though I was with her day and night. You know, she would just avoid eye contact, defer to me with like very curt, cold answers if she had to speak to me. And they threatened firing. I was sent to therapy with a colleague of mine at Tara Mandala. I was told that I was within 2 weeks of starting my job and all the rugs in the world being pulled out from under me. I was told that by Soltram that I was too unstable to continue working there, and that the only way she would allow me to continue working at Tara Mandala and not fire me is if I did therapy with my colleague. And I avidly agreed, but this also so early on positioned me in such a disempowering way that I had no credibility psychologically. Like, I was already she would later go on to discredit me as a reliable narrator and just being like, she did things later on repeatedly that would make me constantly question my sanity and my perception, which was by design. But this was, you know, this was the earliest installment of that, was that I was so unstable that this entire world and life that I had devoted myself to was something I was actually very unworthy of. So yeah, it put me in a position where I had to immediately renegotiate our terms, and the terms were, putting me in this very, very low position. And then I attended these sessions with this therapist, and, you know, I bore my soul to her. I was really in crisis, because when you live in the Rocky Mountains in a small community and no one will talk to you, you, for a prolonged period of time, you experience devastating effects of exile and isolation. And, you know, the whole time I was, of course, blaming myself for being completely shut out by my community. One day, after a few months in these sessions, Deborah says to me, Sophia, because I had admitted that I was disassociating a lot because things were so severe. And so she decided that this was her moment to make the connection that would ultimately really invalidate me permanently as an employee. So she made this connection. She said, Sophia, I think you are disassociating a lot. And I think that that's the reason you're so bad at your job. And, you know, in these sessions, I wasn't going into the session saying, I'm so bad at my job. I don't know what to do. How can I be a better employee? I was going in saying, no one will talk to me. I feel like I'm going insane. I can't sleep at night. I'm having this crushing experience of social isolation. What is happening to me? And, you know, I'm getting further and further away from my body. And I had never volunteered any kind of opinion of myself as doing a poor job. So this was coming from outside. It was coming from the perception of the community without my collaboration. And it was put upon me as a fact that I'm so bad at my job, and that now that she had all this dirt on me, she could use my vulnerability to psychologically interpolate me into how unworthy I was. Like, it was a position where how could I refute that I was bad at my job when she had all of this evidence that I was psychologically too unwell to perform a job adequately. You know, it was so startling. Clearly she was, sharing what was going on in my sessions with Lama Soltram. These were absolutely not, held in confidence, which I'd been led to believe that it was actual therapy and it would be treated that way. But, and then when I said this to her, I was like, what's going on? How can you say this to me? This is so inappropriate. Just like a stone, she became very, cold and emotionless and said, no, Sophia, this is exactly what this is for. And you've known that the whole time. So just very like Stepford Wife, mask comes off. Oh no, you've known this whole, like, this is what you agreed to. You are, you know, being subject to, a form of psychological torture. You know, they had me by the balls, and I wasn't really allowed to eat meals during my work day. You know, like, what if Lama Soltram needed, you know, what if she was thirsty and needed water but didn't feel like getting up? Like, God forbid, what would happen? And we don't want to even find out. So I had to be on call all day long. When I got hungry, it, you know, and I was weak and just exhausted, you know, my brain is malnourished. It didn't matter. You know, Lama Sultram was always very dismissive and angry whenever I suggested that maybe I could eat lunch while she was eating lunch or something like that. And then on top of it, so I wasn't allowed to take days off. And so I would basically work 30 days straight. That was, you know, what my healthy early 20s year old body could endure before hitting the breaking point of 16 hour days in a row. And then I'd hit the breaking point, I'd get sick and I'd collapse. And then I would not be able to work. And I would get a furious call from Lama Sultram about how, what am I supposed to do now? You know, what am I supposed to do if you're not here to assist me? You really need to work on your bodhicitta, Sophia. And I would say, like, I'm really sorry, but I'm sick. And then she would say, well, you should have had better boundaries and you should have taken a day off. But of course, whenever I asked for a day off, I was told that I had insufficient devotion. So, you know, it was a catch-22. I was never allowed to have needs. And, then it would be met with her fury that I had broken down and could not be at her beck and call. And that the salvation of all sentient beings was at risk because she would have to get her own water. And then, things would happen like one day, she was traveling and I was very sick. Like I had a terrible flu, very high fever. And when I was in my last days of the flu, so I was only getting marginally better, our Kempo, it's a Tibetan word for a religious scholar. We had one who was a Bhutanese monk who was living at Taramandala, and he needed a ride to Santa Fe, which was a 3-hour drive. And our director asked me if I could drive him. The nerve to ask me when I was still so sick, but she asked and I said, listen, I'm still pretty unwell. So if someone else can do it, that would be really great. But if they can't, I will do it. I will make this 6-hour drive. And so she smiled at me and she said, okay, that's perfectly fine, Sophia. I'll go see if someone else can do it. And it turned out someone else could do it. So I was very happy to hear that. And then about, I think like 15 minutes later, or it was sometime later that day, I get a call from Lama Sultram in Europe. And she's ready to curse me out about how I refused to drive Kempo to Santa Fe. And, you know, she goes, I heard that you refused to drive Kempo to Santa Fe and you really have a problem with your bodhicitta, Sophia. And this is completely unacceptable. And I grovel and I try to explain to her how sick I am and that I offered. And then she just giggles like a teenage girl and she goes, oh, well, I'm not there. What do I know? But you really do need to work on your bodhicitta, Sophia. It's a problem. And she gets off the phone. So, I mean, the way that I was conditioned to fear any kind of exercise of boundaries, like you're just constantly by the ball. If you have a boundary, then they take you by the balls and they say that you're a bad person and that that all sentient beings are doomed because of you having a boundary. So anyway, I know that you asked my breaking point and I felt that I needed to, give more background to how horrific the circumstances were, and a lot more transpired, And I was, but basically, I eventually kind of pulled a rabbit out of a hat. I would say it took about a year that from enough scolding and subtle cues, I just put the pieces together for how to really do the job at an expert level. Which is also, you know, like you learn from being around narcissists, you're very good at reading any subtle shift in their energy. And I have a hyper awareness to that. So I really, you know, in a way I was really, you know, I was properly trained by my family to do this job super well. So I finally caught on and I started doing the job really well. Like I was, you know, I was grease lightning. Like I was so undeniably good. I had whatever Soltram wanted before, well before she even realized she wanted it. So when the time came where she was like, oh, I think I need a cough drop, it was already in her hand. And she was like, wow, it's like, it's just the magic that I require of my own, of, you know, of my staff. And so, so I was really good. And so, you know, the community was finally softened a bit. But still, I was ultimately still being treated like I was garbage. I was just constantly being mocked, constantly undermined, really... You know, still they were threatening firing me on a regular basis. And, you know, Soltram made petty, cruel comments on a regular basis. And what really, it just became so much harder for me to justify their behavior because now I was really good at my job. So when I was bad at it, it was like, yeah, well, of course I don't deserve to be treated like a human being because I haven't, I don't deserve it. Cause look at how I'm failing this community. But now there was no way that anyone could say I was failing the community, but I was still being treated like I was human garbage. So that was when, that was like the first crack in the veneer. And then, you know, because I was doing such a good job, I was kind of like let into Soltram's, I was in like her good graces, so to speak. But her good graces are kind of just as crappy as her bad graces, it turns out. And I had always wanted to get into her good graces because it looked so good from the outside. It, you know, it seemed like the other assistant, she so favored her. And I thought, wow, they have so much fun together. I would really love if I was worthy of that kind of affection. And so anyway, finally I got it. She threw a garden party. Well, I threw the party and, it was a really elaborate, three ring circus and I pulled it off and she was pretty happy with me, but she was still so rude, so condescending. And she wanted to dress me up like a doll that night. So she did my hair and my makeup and it was so like the ultimate experience of intimacy and affection that you could get from her. And I have to say it smelled like a cheap, I would say a cheap, you know, I guess we can't say that word, but it was like, it was such a cheap version of what I thought it would be. It was like, you know, getting a bootleg Fendi bag or something. Like the inside, it's just plastic. It's so low quality. The stitching is terrible. Like, you know, I thought I was getting milk and honey, but it was high fructose corn syrup. Like it made me gag. Like it was disgusting what her affection was really like. And so, that was it for me. I was like, oh, this is it. So not only have these combined data points of, I'm good at my job, I'm still treated like I'm garbage, and I finally got the trophy at the top of the mountain. It turns out that the trophy is like a flaming pile of dog poo. And I don't think I want this stinky dog poo after all. So basically it took another year. So that was at the year and a half point. It took another year for me to fully become disillusioned. Like, I had to put the pieces together. Like, I would go into a meeting and everyone was just like, you know, people at Taramandala, they work until they collapse. Like my story, but everybody's got their own tailor-made version of what Sultram is doing to them and requiring of them. And, you know, I remember there were so many older women, like women in their late 50s, early 60s, and they were being worked to the point of collapse. And everybody would kind of just giggle about it in meetings, like, yeah, Peg collapsed last week. Isn't that fun? And I was just like, you know, my eyes were open. I was like, no, it's not fun. What are we doing here? This is a Buddhist center. And for no reason at all, what we're requiring of each other is pure torture. Like, you know, we're supposed to be saving all sentient beings, and apparently none of us are sentient beings. Like, it was just wild, and none of them could see it. And I would speak out in meetings, and I would protest, like, why are we doing this? And you know, Sultram, not only is she impossible on a one-on-one basis, but like she's a capitalist. She believes in infinite expansion of her Dharma center. So even though it was only a skeleton staff of like 12 people working themselves to the bone, and we could barely maintain the existing facilities, she always wanted to add another building or add another pond, even though we're at high altitude desert and it's completely unsustainable because of the grandeur of it all and how good it would make her look. So there were always these new enormous projects everybody has to keep up with. And then even just setting up for retreats, Taramandala's a retreat center. So we had, groups of 20, 15, 20, 30, 40 people coming in every week. And, you know, Lama Sultram would say, I want the shrine room set up this way. And we'd set it up. And then 5 minutes before the retreatants come into the room, she goes, actually, I want the opposite. And then we had to tear everything down, change it around, and then we do it. And she goes, oh no, I actually really liked it the way it was before. So change it back. And then, so everybody's just, you're just running around like your hair is on fire. Your heart is about to burst from having a heart attack of how much pressure is on you. And, you know, there wouldn't be pressure on you if we all just recognized that the emperor is not wearing clothes. But because it's a cult, all of her terrible, infantile, bratty behavior is framed as divine. It's divine entitlement, you know? It's like she's getting all of these messages. She's downloading messages from the Dharmakaya, which is the that's like the Harvard of the enlightened planes. It's the highest one. And so every horrible behavior that she displayed, we would attribute to just how high her level of enlightenment was. Because we were like, well, nobody with an ego could ever act this way because it would just be too embarrassing. So she's just, you know, I think of it as like, it's like fine, or not fine art, it's like modern art. The cult functions in the same way bad modern art functions. Like, people can be conned by it because they themselves lack enough art self-esteem to just call a spade a spade. So they think, oh, I'm not getting it. Like, I don't get this Jeff Koons giant animal balloon. I don't get why this is a big deal, but it seems like it's a big deal. So, and I'm probably just stupid and I don't get it. So actually I'm gonna, you know, just think that it's just that high above me. And actually Jeff Koons is not a good artist. And that's the problem. And so, and actually Lama Soltram is not enlightened. She's a malignant narcissist, and that's why she's acting like that. And I'm just glad that I got to put down Jeff Koons at some point publicly in this interview. But you know, if there's a way, I'm very glad I can find it. You know, if I can two birds with one stone, you know, two very untalented birds with one stone.
Sophia May, wow, what a tale! And this idea of divine entitlement. You see this in all kinds of cults, including national cults we have, where we are approving or dismissing of obnoxious behavior of the leader. That's outrageous. That's horrible. But somehow they are a savior. They're special. So they're only human. We can overlook that. But no, we shouldn't be doing that. You know, you also spoke about coming in feeling like a victim, and I was in this position a lot as a younger person myself. When you're a victim, bullies detect that, and they start pecking it. Like if there's a crowded chicken coop and one chicken gets a spot of blood on it, all the other chickens start pecking it to death. So they can smell people who are vulnerable, and that's how you came into this. And you were subject to shunning, some real unethical manipulation by a therapist. I'm really almost criminal level. And this is what a lot of these religions do, and these psychological techniques. They manipulate you. They find out your personal information and they use it against you.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
just so sinister. I mean, it. Again, can we just leave this stuff to the people selling soda pop? Yeah, it's okay. You know, you're selling used cars. We get it. You're manipulating people. That's okay. But when it comes to spirituality, religion, something that's supposed to lift us up and help us heal, can we at least be a little more protective of that and just allow in honest, good-hearted souls instead of these sinister monsters? Anyway, you've shared a lot, and I'm very grateful for this time you've taken with me. You are also a comedian. We have had some humor, but do you want to do a little bit of shtick in the final few moments we have?
Oh, yeah, I would adore that. I'll maybe share like a bit that I'm working on. So as you know, I'm working on a full hour-long stand-up comedy solo about my experience as Lama Soltram's assistant. It is called The Buddha Wears Prada. I have to say that when that movie, the Devil Wears Prada, it came out when I started working at Taramandala, and Soltram saw it, and I wasn't with her at the time, but according to some other inner circle people, they watched it together, and she was like, "I'm not like that, am I?" And everyone just was so uncomfortable because she is much worse. She is truly much worse. She's hippie. She's hippie Anna Wintour. But I will say, if I can get away with this bit, so Lama Soltram has gained tremendous credibility in the Buddhist world because she was recognized as a reincarnation of the 11th century yogini master, Machi Klopchan. And a lot of people would say, like, oh, like, she's such a terrible person. She's obviously a fraud. Like, she can't actually be a reincarnation of this woman because she's so terrible and such a... Yeah, bitch. Okay, so everybody's like, she's such a bitch. How she's clearly a phony and not a reincarnation of this woman. And I'd say, like, no. Like, I think she's definitely a reincarnation of Machi Klopchan, and I just think Machi was probably a huge bitch. I think there's actually historic evidence of what a huge bitch Machi was, Because Machik is considered a deity now in the Tibetan Buddhist pantheon. And normally, the deities are painted in very colorful, with a very colorful palette. So they're blue, they're green, they're red, they're gold. And Machik was such a bitch that the Tibetans depicted her as a white woman.
And you should
look her up. It's really kind of spectacular. And you know, the funny thing is that they had a... So Machik Labdron had this teacher named Dampa Sanjay. And Dampa Sanjay had his, like, his story is that he had an accidental body swap with someone. It was like, I think this is what the basis of Freaky Friday is based on. And so it's Dampa Sanjay's body swap. And Dampa Sanjay ended up accidentally body swapping with a lower caste, dark skinned Indian man. And thereafter, he was always referred to as Little Black Dampa whenever he was in connection to Machik. You know, it was always Little Black Dampa and Machik this, Little Black Dampa and Machik that. And I think that the reason that he's referred to this way is because it was really important to Machik that people know she has black friends.
Wow. You've got a whole special coming out in the next few months.
The Buddha Wears Prada, and the Edinburgh Fringe, if people don't know, is the largest arts festival in the entire world, and it is actually the third most ticketed event in the entire world. So the first one is the Olympics, the second one is the World Cup, and the third one is the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. So it is a huge honor to get to do my show there. And I'm so excited, and, you know, I'll be doing more podcasts about it and just hopefully getting the word out.
You can be found on Instagram at Sophia May Comedy. There's a lot of brilliant material there. And I think we should end this interview with a final observation on my part. I think people like you and me are helping to unknot this mess, partially through radio and interview and talking about it and confiding our difficult journeys, but also through comedy and art and Jeff Koons balloons. No, not that. But I think we should also consider that all of the world's problems right now may be due to the fact that you weren't available to Saltram Alioni to provide her with her throat lozenge, and you totally screwed up the world's bodhicitta. This might be all your fault.
Oh my God. I think she would totally agree. That is so brilliant. Do you mind if I use that in my show?
Oh my God.
And give you no credit for it?
I love it. Well, it's been wonderful. I say we check in the next 6 months or so. And because you're evolving, you're healing, you're getting more of a perspective, as am I. Decades later, I'm still understanding things like, oh, that thing kind of sucked when the guru guy poached my girlfriend. Yeah, that wasn't right. And I didn't realize that till like last year or so. Let's keep the discussion going and be resources for the community. But thank you so much. Any closing words?
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me. This was such a pleasure. It was really fun and it was really deep. And just for anyone who's been through this kind of thing, lone wolf activities are the antidote. Just really finding your compass, your North Star within yourself. And for me, that's been comedy. It's a lone wolf sport. And it's all about critical thinking and turning what you thought you knew on its head. Just try to listen to your gut.
Sophia May at Sophia May Comedy on Instagram. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you so much for your time, Mystic Pete. It was a blast.